Sarah Parker. I'm an independent radio producer in New Mexico. This spring, I had the opportunity to interview director of the International Indian Treaty Council, Andrea Carmen, about the Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Declaration is a document which took 30 years to develop and ratify in the UN Permanent Forum for Indigenous Peoples. While it took 30 years and centuries of experience of conquest and genocide on indigenous peoples around the globe, the document outlines human rights that all peoples should have in the world. I joined the northern route of the second longest walk in Horton, Kansas, in April of this year. In St. Louis, the International Indian Treaty Council gave a workshop for walkers to better understand the Declaration. The walk's focus was the environment and sacred sites, both of which are deeply connected to culture and therefore to human rights. Director Andrea Carmen led the workshop, and afterwards, back at the camp on the Mississippi, I spoke to Ms. Carmen about the Declaration. We sat outside of a surreal model of Lewis and Clark's small river fort. In the midst of tornado warnings and thunderstorms, the fireplaces and bunks kept us warm. In the background, you can hear some of the children and walkers. Here's the interview. Could you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Andrea Carmen. I'm the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, and I'm from the Yaqui Indian Nation.
Can you explain what the International Indian Treaty Council does?
The International Indian Treaty Council was founded back in 1974 to provide an international voice for indigenous peoples, for grassroots and tribal traditional peoples at the United Nations and in the international arena. It was founded because indigenous peoples, American Indians, we used to say back in the day, realized that there was no justice in the court systems or the legislative systems or the legal systems of the countries that we live in for core issues like treaty rights, land rights issues, cultural rights, sovereignty recognition issues. So the decision was to go seek a voice in the international arena, and the IITC, or International Indian Treaty Council, was formed to do that and was the first indigenous organization to have what's called consultative status with the UN Economic and Social Council, or be recognized to have an official voice at the United Nations back in 1977. Now we're happy to say there are many, many indigenous peoples from literally all continents and all countries around the world where indigenous peoples are that are participating at the United Nations. And it's through this work in collaboration with what became a global movement of indigenous peoples at the United Nations that we got finally, after 30 years, the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples adopted at the UN General Assembly last September, September 13th, 2007, as one of our many accomplishments, taking the voice of indigenous peoples directly into the international arena. Part of what we were founded on was the principle that indigenous peoples speak for ourselves in the international arena. We're not represented by the nation states or by the countries that are members of the UN. So we've had to develop our own voice and take our own expertise and our own knowledge about our struggles and even some of our traditional knowledge into a whole range of different kinds of meetings and discussions happening internationally, many of which impact our day-to-day lives. A good example right now is the focus on impacts of the climate change disaster that we're seeing and are affecting indigenous peoples first, because it's really affecting our food sovereignty as well as our way of life in many places, and we're just seeing the very beginning right now of what's to come. So these are issues that Indigenous peoples have a lot of traditional knowledge. We have prophecies, we have adaptation strategies that come from our own traditional understanding of the way we have to live with the earth that are actually being sought out now by the United Nations and our input into the discussions that are happening. Even though in many ways we don't have an equal voice, still it's a voice that can't be ignored.
You said, you know, that you all also work on issues of sovereignty, and can you explain what sovereignty means?
Well, the international definition of self-determination is something that's already been recognized by the world community in many international conventions and treaties as belonging to all peoples. The UN was founded on the basis of self-determination for all peoples, not all countries or nation states. And that definition is that all peoples have the right to self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. So to freely pursue your, freely determine your political status is the right of all peoples to determine what relationship you have to any other entities through treaties, through being a sovereign independent country, to having an association with nation states. The treaty making process is a good example of an exercise of the right to self-determination. But it also implies the right of a people to decide that for themselves and to control every aspect, you know, economic, cultural, social, of their own destiny, and determine those structures and institutions for themselves. So I think that's a really good definition of sovereignty. Sovereignty is one possible exercise of the right of self-determination. Others that some Indigenous peoples have chosen are more like an autonomy situation, where you're a nation within a nation. For many of the nations around the world, that's the formula that they think works best for them. But no Indigenous peoples that I've ever heard of are willing to give up control over their own traditional lands, the right to practice their cultures, the right to determine their own form of government. And these are elements of sovereignty that I think everyone has in common as Indigenous peoples.
Can you talk a little bit about the declaration that you had mentioned that passed?
Sure. Well, we went into the United Nations to address violations of treaty rights and human rights, and quickly saw back in the late 70s and early 80s that part of the problem is the way that Indigenous peoples understood, the way we understood our own rights, wasn't necessarily the way they had been defined by the nation states or by other cultures. For example, the right to property under international law is in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, but it's mainly understood to be an individual right, whereas the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples upholds the collective rights to land, and that's why it's called the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, plural, you know, as collectivities, as distinct entities, as nations. We have an exercise of rights that is exercised through our collectivity, our collectiveness, our right to practice our freedom of religion, to maintain our language, to protect and defend and use and control our lands and resources. Those are collective rights for Indigenous peoples. The right to food sovereignty is a collective right. We don't own this knowledge. We don't own the knowledge about our seeds and our plants or our songs individually. These things are not only collectively owned, they're multi-generational, and they're passed down from generation to generation. So we needed to define human rights in a new way for Indigenous people, certainly not really creating new rights, but just talking about them in different ways. And the other part of it was that even though many of the rights are clearly and very well defined in international law, many of the nation states, including the United States, wanted to maintain the position that somehow they don't apply to indigenous peoples. All peoples have the right to self-determination, but the U.S. position, until very, very recently, and I would say it hasn't changed at its fundamental quality, is that indigenous peoples aren't really peoples. That was their way of getting away from that, that somehow we're populations or minorities or what was one formulation they wanted to use instead of peoples, persons belonging to indigenous groups. They tried all kinds of ways to get away from the legal accountability they had to uphold conventions they'd already agreed to that said all peoples have the right to self-determination. Their way of trying to say that doesn't apply to indigenous peoples is by saying we're not peoples. They couldn't really explain based on what criteria, because clearly indigenous peoples are peoples, and it became kind of ridiculous after a while until finally they had to give in, at least agree to the use of the term peoples in the document. But when we first started, a lot of the countries didn't want to use the term peoples. And so we were able to adopt, when the UN Commission on Human Rights set up a working group in 1995 to address how to work towards adopting the declaration, using a text that had already been developed with the input of states and UN experts and indigenous peoples by the Working Group on Indigenous Populations. It stayed there for about 12 years, and then it moved into the Commission on Human Rights, and they set up a working group. And within a couple of years, we had, number one, won the right through a walkout and a threatened boycott of the whole process to have an equal voice in the in development of the text or agreements of the text. And second, two articles had been adopted, but they were two that didn't use the word peoples. Most of the articles in the UN Declaration start with the phrase indigenous peoples have the right to, you know, not be relocated, have the right to use, control, and own their traditional lands, practice their culture, have education in their language, etc., 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 maintain the productive capacity of their lands, maintain the control of their culture, have access to their sacred sites. But it starts with that phrase, indigenous peoples have the right, almost every single article of the Declaration. So two were adopted that didn't use the word peoples, and then it took us about 9 years to adopt any more than that. And really, the fight was over that S. It's so strange that one letter could make all the difference. They wanted to say people, like there's a lot of people standing in the parking lot over there. That's a big difference legally in international law from peoples. The all peoples have the right to self-determination language, what they call it, the Article 1 in common of the two human rights covenants. When you hear the all peoples language, that phrase means that all peoples have the right to self-determination. So they wanted to somehow find a way to create a second-class set of rights for indigenous peoples, which is against the principle of non-discrimination, which is the basis of international law. One of the fundamental principles of the founding of the UN is that human rights are equal and inalienable. And inherent for all members of the human family, all peoples. If all peoples have the right to something, you can't say except these peoples because we don't like it, you know, or we're threatened by it, or our colonial system was undermined if they suddenly are recognized with rights. It just didn't hold water. You know, we fought and fought and fought for a long time, and part of it was education and part of it was challenging. We had a hunger strike. We were strongly opposed to any kind of language that would be discriminatory or create a lesser set of rights for indigenous peoples, especially in the name of creating a declaration for the rights of indigenous peoples. It was very difficult, and really until the last couple years it didn't look like it was going to go. But suddenly I think the states, maybe after the hunger strike, the chair from Peru, Luis Chavez, said that to him changed things. But I think they saw how serious we were, and also we got the word out. You know, you have to do something newsworthy to get the word out. People didn't want to hear, oh yeah, they're going to Geneva, another session of the discussion that goes nowhere. It suddenly galvanized indigenous peoples around the world to pay attention to this process and to state how they felt even from afar, or to, you know, talk to the, whatever government, you know, country they lived in, to say we're not going to accept, you know, compromise on key aspects like the land rights, self-determination, use of the term peoples without qualification, the cultural rights, treaty rights, all of those elements. We saw that there was going to be a need for some adjustment. And we had a lot of problem with it because people felt that even to get it to that point, there had already been compromise from what we would have originally liked. But realistically, it wasn't us who were going to vote at the end. This was a declaration of the United Nations, and those nations are countries in the language of the UN is an organization of nation states, of countries. So there was a lot of negotiation and very difficult, and it was very discouraging for many years, but we felt we had to be there because if we weren't, what would they come up with? It wouldn't be good. We owed it. We got the process going, so we kind of owed it to, you know, future generations to make it come out as strong as we could possibly get it. And if you read it, it's kind of amazingly strong, especially since it was the countries that voted on it. It wasn't us, so... You know, it was an amazing process because another thing that it created, kind of in spite of itself, was a global movement of indigenous peoples. I know you'd asked me questions about food sovereignty. And one thing, you know, we held out for this no change of the text adopted by the working group for about 8 years. And it actually helped us. That was one of our strategies. Besides, we really did like that document. But it blocked really bad changes that would probably have gotten a lot of support by some of the countries, a lot of the countries, until we could actually go through an education process with them, and that was a lot of it. But once we saw that there was going to have to be some changes to get it adopted, we actually worked on a few of the different articles to make them stronger. And one thing we were able to get in there is control over genetic resources. That wasn't in the original text that we were fighting for, because who knew about genetic resources in the 1980s, you know, genetically modified seeds and plants. No one knew about that stuff. So that was one example of how we were actually able to strengthen the text about the resources of flora and fauna, and not just the knowledge, but the use of, and also genetic resources is specifically mentioned in that article. Another one is the article on border rights and the rights of indigenous peoples that are divided by borders. We were also able to strengthen the treaty language. And there are a couple areas that the states kind of went out on, and there's a few language like Article 46 we don't really care for very much, but we felt that it didn't undermine, and that's the language that actually came in at the very last couple weeks of negotiation once we were in New York. The African states really insisted on it, and none of the countries could oppose it, you know. And it was the language says nothing in this declaration can be used to undermine the territorial integrity or political unity of states. But that language is in the UN Charter already, and the declaration already referred to upholding the Charter, and no one can go against the Charter, and, you know, we understand that. It's a human rights document. It's not a document that really has jurisdiction to break up states. You know, there is a decolonization process in the UN, and that's a different process. A human rights process is not really capable of saying that it's for dismembering states. But we didn't want that language in there, that we didn't want it. And we feel, though, if you look at Article 26, which upholds the rights of indigenous peoples to own, control, and use the lands that we have always traditionally owned, used, and controlled and occupied, and Article 37 on treaties, that's our territorial integrity. So as most human rights documents, it's a balance. And if your intent is to break up the territorial integrity of existing states, you can't use the declaration to do it, but there are other mechanisms at the United Nations and on the home front that you can use clearly, you know. We used to say, wait a minute here, there's 10 countries in the room that didn't exist 10 years ago. What does Ukraine have to say about territorial integrity of existing states? You know, they're sitting there voting and clearly it's not indigenous peoples who are undermining the political integrity and, you know, territorial unity of states. So,
which African states were they?
All the African states. All of the African states. What happened was the declaration was adopted at the first meeting of the new Human Rights Council that replaced the Commission on Human Rights in 2006, in June 2006. And everyone was all happy. You know, there's some language that the chair had actually come up with, compromise language, but I would say about 80% of it went our way because the working group couldn't reach consensus on the key points on land, especially. You can imagine. It's how this started, land and resources. So, you know, it's no wild guess that would be the sticking point. But free prior informed consent was another one that the states couldn't agree with the language that we were insisting on, which was the obligation to obtain and not to seek. You know, they had to get it, not just go through the motions of saying, well, we tried, we couldn't convince them, so we'll do it anyway. It wouldn't take the money, you know, whatever. But it says obtain, and we clearly, you know, won the day on that one. I would say of the language in the declaration, more than 80% was agreed to by consensus of indigenous peoples and states. Of what wasn't agreed to, the chairman basically used his prerogative when it was clear there wasn't consensus. And of the changes of the text he came up with and presented to the Human Rights Council, about 80% went in the way that we wanted it to go to. So, you know, some of the states like U.S. and Canada were clearly very upset by the chairman's compromise text. It mainly went our way, which we were really happy to see. I was amazed to see that he put obtain free prior informed consent because it wasn't clear. At the end of the last session, it was just clearly Canada and others said forget it, we won't agree to that, and he put it in anyway, so that's pretty good. U.S. totally opposed the language on treaties, but they were pretty much alone. You know, they had a very embarrassing moment being the only country that totally talked against the treaty language in the document. So, but he had to come up with what's called the chair's text that was presented to the Human Rights Council. It got approved. Then it was going to the General Assembly, and everyone thought, you know, it would just, you know, it wouldn't get unanimous support, but it would have enough. Two states voted against it at the Human Rights Council. That's Canada and Russian Federation. The U.S. is not a member of the Human Rights Council. Canada kind of carries their water for them there. And also Australia and New Zealand are not. So the members that are members there's 49, I think, members of the Human Rights Council, and two voted against. Even some African states there voted for. But then when it got to the General Assembly, it goes first to a body called the Third Committee, which deals with human rights. We tried to keep it out of there and just go straight for a vote at the General Assembly of the text that was adopted by the Human Rights Council. But the African states blocked it, basically, and they have enough support. There's lots of them. So they said they hadn't really been that involved in the process, which is true, even though they could have been. The working group was open to everyone. They just couldn't really fathom the issue of indigenous rights. There's a lot of tribal conflicts in Africa. They were concerned about, again, territorial integrity. These are states that just became independent in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone's thinking there, you know, Rwanda and the Hutus and the Tutsis, and what's going to happen if, you know, they all want to go off their own way, and is this going to cause more conflict? And they just had a lot of questions, some of which actually were understandable, even though we were very unhappy about what happened, that they delayed the adoption for another year. And at the end, they came up with a document as a block, as all of them. There was clearly some in the forefront of, you know, opposing it, but they stuck together like they usually do as a block and proposed more than 40 changes in the articles, some of which were horrible. They wanted the whole article on self-determination out completely, for example, and, you know, just out, any mention of free, prior, informed consent out, and just a lot of things out. Statements like all of the rights in the Declaration are subject to the jurisdiction of domestic law. Well, why have international law then? We already have domestic law in every single country. So those kinds of things. It was like an extreme proposal from them. And what happened in the end is a group of countries that were the sponsors for the adoption, mainly Latin American countries, I think led by Mexico, Guatemala, and Peru, not part of. We were not invited. We were not part of those discussions to try to see if they could come up with something that would be acceptable to the states that were sponsoring the adoption and the Africans. Because what was clearly the choice at that point, and that's something we understood too when it was finally brought to us, because the sponsors, like I said, led by Mexico, Peru, and Guatemala, who had been states that had been very, very favorable to the work on the Declaration, and taking into consideration our point of view on it, they did come to what was called the Global Caucus. We'd set up a structure the year before where every region, all seven indigenous peoples' regions, had selected a couple of co-coordinators that would be responsible for getting information out in their region and then bringing it back to the body. And I was the North America co-coordinator, along with Chief Ed John from British Columbia. So the Thursday before Labor Day, which was, I don't know, what was that, like the 5th of September, they brought us the document, which it was a product of very hard negotiations between the African bloc and the Latin Americans, mainly, to boil down the African changes to nine changes, and presented them to the Global Steering Committee. We're all there because we're expecting the vote any minute. And our responsibility was to get it out to our regions, you know, to all the organizations on our regional mailing list, with the explanation that, look, we're not saying, do we like these changes or not? No, we don't. We don't like two of them, actually, we thought improved the text. Others were small. Two we really did not like. And but the question was, are these a deal breaker? With the other parts intact, you know, land rights, treaty rights, free, prior, informed consent, self-determination untouched, were these changes a deal breaker? Because the co-sponsoring country said, look, if the indigenous peoples tell us we don't want you to submit this, we won't do it. We'll use the text adopted by the council. But what's going to happen is we may have enough votes to get it adopted on a squeaker in the General Assembly, but we won't have enough votes to block unfriendly amendments, which will come first. Canada had a list of amendments already published, and they were terrible. Africa then would go back to their original amendments. It would be a free-for-all on the floor of the General Assembly, and there was also a good chance that the chair would say, hey, you know, we don't do this here. This is supposed to be all worked out before it gets to the floor of the General Assembly. You don't have debates there. You know, all of that is supposed to happen way down the pike at the UN. She could either call a halt and say, look, we're going to have to reopen the whole thing up to negotiation again, start again from scratch, which would be bad, or accept amendments from the floor. And we knew what they would be. They would make a declaration that would actually be against Indigenous peoples, because we'd seen the amendments, Canada's amendments. And the other thing is, as they explained to us, that if this process really went on much farther, Canada hadn't been part of the process of negotiation, and they were the most aggressive with some really bad amendments. So the question for Indigenous peoples was, are these a deal breaker? Because they would have, the co-sponsors would have submitted the council text. But they told us straight out they do not have the votes to block unfriendly amendments, because amendments come first before the final vote. If it was a straight up and down vote, we probably could have squeaked it. So the choice wasn't this one or nothing. The choice was this one or a bad, really bad one. Or starting a process all over again that would not include Indigenous peoples the way the process in Geneva had, because in New York it's the General Assembly and we don't have a standing there, like we do, say, at the Human Rights Council. So, you know, that was the choice, and it went out far and wide. And I was responsible for collecting the responses we had over the weekend. Monday was Labor Day, so we asked till Tuesday to get the responses. Wednesday, we had to meet with the co-sponsor group, and the vote was Thursday. You know? So, I mean, this was like a total time crunch. A lot of people were really upset. They said, what are you telling us? We're supposed to, like, confer with our tribes and our communities. And we said, you know, this is not our schedule. Do your best. We're trying to just do our best. And we knew in that short a time consensus was not going to be possible among the regions or within the regions. So we were going to have to go with the vast overwhelming majority. And the overwhelming majority in North America, I can speak for, said either, well, we weren't really part of the negotiation for this, however, the stuff we really care about is still intact, so we will support them, not support the changes, but support them to go ahead and submit it, understanding, you know, the whole scenario, because we explained it really well when we sent it out to everybody. Others said, we will not oppose. I would say most of the people in the region, including the International Indian Treaty Council, because I had to go through a consensus process among our board on it really quick, who are from not just North America, but Latin America and the Pacific, and most said, we can't say we support because we were not part of the negotiations on these last things. However, we appreciate the historic effort to go from 39 to just 9, most of which aren't a problem on the changes. We don't like those last two, but it was on the military intervention article and the territorial integrity article. We don't like it, but it doesn't wreck it. It's not a deal breaker. We don't oppose. We'll just say we won't oppose them submitting it. So that was the vast majority of the responses. Some regions came back, according to the regional coordinators, as you know, in consensus for saying, we can support. We don't like, but we can support them submitting it for a vote in this way. And that's the one that got adopted. We did come back and say, we need the assurance that Africa will vote against any amendments on the floor if we give our okay to this. We need that. And so they got us that assurance that if amendments were submitted, that Africa would join with Latin America to oppose them. So we wouldn't be making a deal and then get worse at the same time. We had to assure that. So we did get that.
And did anything come up?
Nope. No amendments. We had the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, and Australia all spoke in advance to speak against, kind of like their last ditch effort to say, we don't oppose indigenous rights. In fact, we're really for them and we really uphold them and our countries are great. However, this declaration has problems because it's not clear and it's the wordings. Yeah, they wouldn't say it goes too far. We'll never accept these rights. You know, they just said it's not clear. It's going to be impossible to implement. The wording isn't precise enough. You know, stuff like that. So it's going to cause problems, da 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 da. So they couldn't convince anyone else. I think there were 11 abstentions altogether, which isn't very many. We thought there'd be a lot more abstentions. We didn't really think 144 countries would vote in favor. So now we have a tool, you know, the declaration. We fought to keep the language throughout, and it has it. It says it's a minimum standard. You know, it's not shoot the moon. This is the minimum. This is a negotiated text, and it's not everything we wanted, but it's a good minimum. It's the minimum required. And some of it, as we talked about today, is a lot more than the minimum. A recognition of rights to all the land that we traditionally owned, occupied, or otherwise used, you know. That language is very strong. Mm-hmm. The full right of self-determination under international law. Recognized for indigenous peoples, you know, treaty rights, really strong language. There's just a lot of really strong language, free prior informed consent, the obligation of states to obtain it, not just for development projects, but for legislation and administrative actions, which may, the word is may, affect indigenous peoples in Article 19. Strong language against forced relocation, you know, upholding rights to education in our language and to control of our education systems and to control of our health systems and control of the use of our land and our intellectual property. You know, all of those things is in it. You know, our subsistence rights, all of those things. So I think we actually really got an amazing document, given the fact it was the countries that had to vote in favor of it at the end. It wasn't us. I have to hand it to all of us, I think, you know, involved in the process, and all of the grassroots peoples and indigenous peoples that supported and made their voices known on this process throughout the years, because a lot of people worked on it who didn't ever set foot in Geneva or New York. They worked on it from their communities, you know, at their national capitals, at meetings and conferences on such a range of issues. So I think it's really important. It was really good to give that training today, because the Longest Walk, too, is really part of the implementation of the Declaration. And now we have recognition internationally that we do have rights to our sacred sites, and we do have rights to our land, and rights to our resources and our and the productive capacity of our natural environment, which means keeping it clean, and, you know, right to our health and, you know, our culture. All of those different things are there. So it's something that we can use, and something we can tell other indigenous peoples about, something we can use at the local school board or the local health board or the local clinic or with the teachers of our, you know, kids in school. You know, our kids have a right to education in their language and culture. We have a right to say what their education is going to be. You know, all of those things. We're really working on the international level, and we've already gotten strong support. The Belize Supreme Court, the country of Belize, has used the Declaration in a recent court decision. The Inter-American Human Rights Court has used the Declaration. The United Nations Committee on Elimination of Racial Discrimination just 2 months ago held the United States accountable to upholding the Declaration. They used the word notwithstanding the fact they voted against it. This is international standard right now. It's been accepted overwhelmingly, and those states that voted against it, they had their shot, you know. They made their wishes known, but it doesn't mean they're exempt from upholding it. So I think that's very important for those of us indigenous peoples in U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Actually, Australia has, with their new, they have had an election, they have a new government, and they have expressed regret for their vote and expressed a willingness to work with indigenous peoples on implementing the Declaration. They can't take back their vote, but they've peeled off. And then recently, just last month in Canada, the Parliament of Canada voted that Canada was obligated to uphold the UN Declaration. That was the opposition parties, the majority vote. And the Conservative government still is the government, but all the opposition parties in the Parliament, I mean the vote won in the Parliament, that the Canadian government is obligated to uphold it. So their own Parliament. And the question is, are they going to uphold a democratic process in their own country from non-Indigenous peoples mainly saying the Canadian government is obligated to uphold the Declaration? I think in Canada the Canadian government has told us they didn't expect this to have such, you know, such a longevity as an issue. It's continuing to be an issue, and a bigger and bigger and bigger issue in the whole political system of Canada, if you can believe that. Unfortunately, that's not the case in the United States. But, you know, it just shows, I think, that we have a lot of work to do here to keep the issue alive and to insist that the United States government comply with the recommendations of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which they are legally bound to uphold. That's a legally binding treaty monitoring body, and the U.S. is a party to the CERD Convention, to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. So it's a ratified treaty by the United States Senate. So let's see if they are going to abide by the rule of law and uphold human rights of Indigenous peoples.
What is it that they're so afraid of? Why don't they? Why did they vote against?
Well, it's an interesting thing, you know. When you've been that abusive to Indigenous peoples or a whole people, I think it makes you afraid. You know, just spiritually somehow. It it makes you paranoid all the time that those who you've abused and are continuing to abuse, those who, whose human rights you violate, you know, are somehow your enemies, and you have to keep them down. Even the international decade of the world's indigenous peoples, now we're in the second decade, calls for a new partnership, a new relationship based on free, prior, informed consent, based on recognition of rights. And this has been adopted by the General Assembly also. The U.S. is part of that. There's a new call, I think, in the world. Now, it doesn't mean we aren't going to have to fight tooth and nail to get it implemented on the ground. But somehow we've achieved, I think, a new time in which indigenous peoples are not invisible anymore, and certainly it's not seen as okay to violate indigenous peoples' rights, or they're not really human anyway, and they don't know how to use the land, so we might as well just take it and make a coal mine, you know, like that. It's not acceptable anymore. It's not carried out with impunity anymore behind closed doors. Indigenous rights are visible. They're right out there in the world arena. And I think the United States is finding itself in an uncomfortable position of being seen by the world community as a state that is not in the mainstream on human rights on many different issues. I explained they were the only country that voted against at the General Assembly the human right to food. The only country, even, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Canada voted for it. They really are very outside the mainstream on upholding human rights. And this is just one more example. It's the one we really care about. But it's not the only example. And we're hoping that maybe partly with walks like this and talking on the radio, that we're going to create the growth of a human rights culture that permeates all peoples and all races and you know, all backgrounds of people, to see that this is the kind of world we want all of our kids to live in, not this thing where we have to be afraid of these guys because we stole their land and they might want to get us somehow, or, you know, those kinds of things. I think we really can, and there is a call internationally for a new phase, a new kind of relationship between states and indigenous peoples and between all peoples. You know, they talk about creation of a human rights culture. That I think if people really think about it, that's what they would like to pass on to their children, you know, of all races, all peoples. So we're part of trying to make that happen, to say, look, this isn't so bad. It's not so bad to recognize. We don't want apology bills and all that stuff. For what? We want a change from now. And it's not too late. There are a lot of struggles that are really at a pivotal moment here for recognition of sacred sites, protection of the environment. Everyone is going to be impacted by this horrible crisis of climate change. And recognition of rights for all peoples is part of that change. And people either have to get with it or they're going to be sorry, I think.
During the workshop, she had related a story about help that they had received from Nobel Prize winner Rigoberto Manchu from Guatemala during the ratification process at the UN. I asked her to share that story again.
Sure. This is part of, you know, the long process of education that we had to embark on with states, all of which, including the ones that came, you know, with us at the end, were really paranoid at the beginning of this process about what it would mean for them to recognize indigenous people's rights. And this was when we were lobbying in 1993 for the creation of the first indigenous decade on the world's indigenous peoples. And we still said peoples, but we knew it was going to be hard going, you know, to get peoples. That's what was so amazing about the adoption of the UN Declaration, first time that it was, you know, used universally like that. But back in that day, it was not really going to be possible, but we were trying hard. And we knew we'd get the decade at the General Assembly, but peoples was really the big question. We wanted to say peoples. It ended up saying people, of the world's indigenous people. But Rigoberta got there and asked us, you know, which of the countries that are the most against the use of the term? peoples. And we said, well, United States. She said, forget it. Canada. I said, well, okay, maybe we can talk to them. I said, and Brazil has really been, you know, making statements against it too. So she said, okay, let's go talk to Brazil. And she asked me and our good friend and associate Willie Littlechild, who's he was the permanent forum representative for North American Indigenous Peoples for 6 years. This is his first year to not be it. He served his term, his allowed term. But so the two of us went with Rigoberta, and we found the ambassador from Brazil. And she said in Spanish, I'm translating to him, why is your government so afraid of recognizing the rights of indigenous peoples? And he said, well, it might cause the breakup of states. We're worried about our territorial integrity. We're worried about conflict inside among, you know, our citizens, etc. And she said, it seems your government is afraid of recognizing the rights of indigenous peoples, but I want to say to you that governments have more to fear from peoples whose rights they deny than from peoples whose rights they recognize. And he drew back like he'd been slapped or hit. I watched him all day. He got like a tick in his eye. He couldn't get rid of it. And I thought, you know, he felt so assaulted by that simple truth. And it's the truth that if it had been one of our Indian men that had said it, I think he would have called security and had them dragged out. You know, he took it like a threat, but it's not a threat. It's the reality. And even the Universal Declaration on Human Rights says that the recognition for all peoples, all members of the human family, of the equal and inalienable rights is the foundation of peace and justice in the world. It's the recognition of rights that brings peace. It's the denial of rights that brings conflict. And through all of these years, talking to all these countries, again and again, we had to remind them of that. You all have said yourselves in your Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is 60 years old now, that it's the recognition of rights is the foundation of peace. Yet you're saying, well, recognizing indigenous people's rights is going to make conflict, and our states will break up, and there'll be war, and there'll be, you know. Why? It's a contradiction on what the founding principle of the United Nations is, that recognition of rights is the foundation of peace. And it is. Isn't it better to have strong, happy, friendly allies than have oppressed, colonized enemies that you're just afraid are going to like get you at the first opportunity, you know? So isn't it a better world for all of our children, you know, to say, why can't we recognize each other with mutual respect and mutual dignity? You know, why do we need to oppress each other? Do we really want each other's stuff that much? Is it, you know, is taking our land and resources that important that you have to live like that and pass that on to your children, where you have to be afraid of recognizing people's rights? You know, what kind of world is that to live in? You know, so I mean, and most of the countries we were able to bring around, because at the very beginning of this process, it was all of the indigenous peoples against almost all of the countries, even to accept the term peoples. And at the end, the countries and indigenous peoples were together, except for just a very few, just a handful. And it was, that alone is kind of an amazing process, that we began to see on this issue, at least, you know, many of the nation states as our close allies. We know they're still doing dirty work, you know, on the ground in their countries. Mexico was a big advocate of the declaration, and we actually have a case filed against them at the Inter-American Human Rights Court for denial of land and water rights. None of them are operating with a clean slate here. But the fact is that they have endorsed a framework which now they are fully aware that they need to be held accountable to, and they can be held accountable to. Unfortunately, they may not hold themselves accountable. It might be us that has to keep on reminding them, but they can't really say much because they have put their weight behind this and said, this is the minimum standard. We agree. This is the least we need to do to make sure indigenous peoples can survive.
the U.S. can be held accountable even though they didn't vote on it, like you said, but how are they held accountable? What are the consequences?
Well, a declaration is not legally binding. A declaration is morally and politically binding. For instance, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights was not adopted by consensus when it was voted on at the General Assembly. And it's not legally binding in a way a convention or a treaty or a covenant is, where it has to be ratified by the country. For instance, the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, or the Convention on Climate Change. Those have to be ratified by the country. It means legally binding, and we accept it, the CERD Convention. So it's not legally binding in that way, but it can become federal law, and it can become customary international law. Now, the Committee on Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which is a legally binding treaty monitoring process for the Convention on Racism, to short form of its name, has said that implementation of the declaration is a criteria that they're asking the United States, and by extension all the other state parties to the CERD, to uphold in the implementation of the CERD Convention having to do with indigenous people. So they've already elevated it to associating it with a legally binding commitment. The Bolivian government has adopted the UN Declaration as federal law. Like I said, the Belize Supreme Court has used the declaration. And we're working on, some of our colleagues are working in Mexico on implementation of certain articles of the Declaration in a review of the Mexican Constitution. So that's one way that it can be used to make law. And that's happening all over the world right now, just because indigenous peoples are pushing for it. Courts are using it. I think the courts in Kenya used it when it was still a draft to make some decisions about indigenous land rights there. So it's being used all over the world like that. And it's just a matter of, are we going to use it? You know, take it into the school board, you know, say this, look, here this is. But there's activity all over the world among indigenous peoples working with states to make it legally binding, even in different aspects of it. And just like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, no country would say, well, that doesn't apply to me, it's just a declaration. It becomes what's called customary international law, which means that it is the accepted norm. And even though you can't be, you know, legally, you know, accountable if you don't uphold it, you know, it takes the force of law. And it's up to us to make sure that happens. You know, we're the ones, we know that in every country, the most friendliest country in the world, Bolivia or wherever, you know, it's still going to have to be indigenous peoples that keep it going, keep it alive, keep it being talked about. And the international arena, it's being used all over the place as a criteria. With the creation of the new expert mechanism for indigenous peoples' rights, which happened last December at the United Nations Human Rights Council, the declaration that establishing that new body, which will meet for the first time later this year, they're selecting the experts now, 5 experts. It mentions the declaration, recognizing the declaration. The declaration will be used as a framework for compliance by states with indigenous people's rights. So it's a matter of using it. And it's happening everywhere. You know, people are using it at the convention on biodiversity discussions. They're using it at, you know, all the different environmental fora. They're using it in every single human rights fora. They're using it at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. They're using it everywhere. So that's what it's going to take until it has such a heavy weight that no one can deny that it's applicable.
Thank you very much for listening.
Sure.
The longest walk continued to Washington, D.C. The walkers and supporters prayed for many different reasons. The declaration encompasses many of those prayers. Human rights and self-determination are paramount to a feeling of well-being and personal power. Michael Lane, who was one of the original walkers in 1978, made it clear that we were going to Washington, D.C., but that was not the end. Lobbying Congress was not the end. The end is in ourselves, and what Washington said matters little. Thank you for listening. I'm Sarah Parker.